I'm Steve Stein, and you're listening to Inside Asia. My guest this episode is Sam Choi, Managing Director of Evolution Advisors, a boutique advisory and investment firm specializing in helping corporates and investors find, evaluate, and execute on deals in Asia. For the decade prior, Sam worked for Microsoft, helping the IT giant identify acquisitions and partnerships across Asia Pacific. I met with Sam at the American Club in Singapore at a frothy point in U.S.-China relations. Political moves by the Trump administration to curtail China's global expansion have riled the Chinese in recent weeks. But nothing, it appears, will stave off the mainland's appetite to grow their presence. I asked Sam to give me his take on what he's seeing in terms of increased Chinese overseas investment.
Backing up a couple of years is, you know, back in the early 2000s, you had many foreign companies making international acquisitions, and they became very comfortable with international acquisitions because they actually had the manpower and the capabilities to put people on staff. And in addition, the companies themselves had processes that they could actually put in place to an acquisition in a remote part of the world. That being said, I saw in the late 2000s, you actually had Chinese capital starting to look overseas. But one of the big differences between Chinese capital as well as, you know, Western capital, as you want to call it, was that they didn't necessarily have all of the processes and procedures in place. And so while they had a lot of capital to deploy, they didn't necessarily know how to deploy it. And so you saw a lot of Chinese capital making initial investments in passive assets, like real estate, or even if it was an active investment, they typically left the management team in place. Of course, over time, as any industry or any economy evolves, they're going to want to put their fingerprints on the business itself. And you see a lot more Chinese companies now starting to think that way in terms of, you know, I'm not just going to put capital, you know, in place and park it overseas because it's a safe investment. I actually need to park capital because I want it to work for me, whether it's for my true international expansion or I want to be able to integrate it into my existing Chinese businesses.
An interesting timing for all this to start to happen, isn't it? Because at a time when globalism is now on the out, nationalism is on the rise, you've got trade wars and barriers that are popping up everywhere, just at a time when China's coming into its own, prepared to deploy that capital in an aggressive, active fashion, and now they've got other things to contend with, don't they?
Absolutely. I mean, you know, Chinese capital has been being deployed overseas for the last several years, and for those that understand, China, people know that the central government, you know, has been, putting in place some capital controls from leaving China because they wanted to protect the local economy. Of course, with all of this, the trade disputes that are happening, there's just the additional added pressure from everybody to understand, well, is this just another piece of tension that's going to make it difficult for Chinese money to move overseas?
Yet, in some ways, for Chinese manufacturers who are bent on export, primarily to the U.S., they're left with no other decision but to diversify their manufacturing base to sidestep some of these tariffs. Do I understand that correctly?
That's right. For many manufacturers, they haven't necessarily adapted to the international expansion mode yet. But that being said, with respect to the current trade tariffs, what is happening is you have Chinese companies actually looking to move their operations overseas to, say, Southeast Asia. And that's actually a huge benefit for one of the firms that I'm representing now, because if you move your operations to Southeast Asia, you're actually removing yourself from the actual trade tariffs between China and the U.S. Make no mistake, you know, the business between U.S. and China will still be the primary business. the manufacturers and suppliers, they're just looking to minimize their additional tax and how their business is being supported.
Right. And there's also this element of diversification. I mean, there are other markets, as Xi Jinping has pointed out, and others beyond the United States. It's maybe now time, China's time to explore, open up, develop other markets. I mean, Africa is a major target for them. It may not have the purchasing power of the U.S., but it certainly has developed bike markets with a rising middle class. Is that part of the plan as well, or is it just purely tactical? Let's just kind of sidestep these tariffs and keep the margins on our business.
That's actually a very complex question.
I'm sure you can deal with it, Sam.
I think you have to think about Chinese investment in multiple strategies. You have certain strategies like Africa, Middle East, part of their overall One Belt, One Road initiative that is very long-term in nature. They're thinking about the next 20, 30 years in developing these markets. With respect to the specific trade war, you know, that is business within the next three months to 1 year that they're trying to develop. And certainly, as I mentioned, as you know, businesses are thinking about moving some of their operations overseas to Southeast Asia primarily, they're just trying to get through the next few months to early few years until the trade settlements, until the political environment changes a bit.
Yeah, fair enough. I'd like to broaden this conversation just a little bit, not just about China money going abroad, but capital pouring into other parts of Asia, Southeast Asia specifically. We've seen the big private equity firms, KKR, TPG, others, launch new funds, raise money, launch funds, multi-billion dollar funds. But there are complications and challenges of deploying capital, private capital in Asia. Can we talk about a few of those things? And what are some of your thoughts about, some of the difficulties these private equity firms or VC firms face?
Well, that, again, that's actually a very complicated question as well. I think, Asia has a lot of interesting dynamics, not the least of which are family offices, large family-controlled enterprises that run a little bit different than traditional, multinational, companies. And then, of course, Asia is also different because you have, a lot of government, control over some assets. I think within the private equity space, you have to actually contend with both those elements in being able to, one, identify opportunities, and then secondly, being able to execute on your overall strategy. There's always the risk that after you make an investment, it doesn't pan out because either, a minority shareholder, decides that they want to sabotage because they're a family control, or you may have a situation where you have a minority investor that might be still a government entity that has a change of control, a change of interest, or a change of agenda at the national level.
Right. And there's been interesting flows around capital moving into Asia as well, because after the global financial crisis, of course, there's major contraction. Everybody kind of went back to their home markets, like the heart, the blood rushes to the core when the appendages are in trouble, or when you're freezing. So this is kind of what was happening, and then all of a sudden there was this recognition, well, there's too much capital that held at these major developed market centers, whether London or New York or elsewhere, we've got to go back out. But in going back out, a lot of people went in with expectations of valuations being reasonable. But in fact, what they've discovered is, by virtue of, as you pointed out, these family-run businesses, the relatively small size of some of these markets in Southeast Asia, it was kind of fragmented. And then you have the other complexities of simply dealing in a developed market where there are issues like corruption, or lack of regulation that gets in the way. So the complexity of investing in Asia seems to have been, in some ways, kind of maybe not surprised, but created a slowdown in the deployment of capital that people hadn't quite anticipated.
I would agree. I think, for the foreseeable future, Asia, specifically Southeast Asia, will be a complex market. And so capital will be, coming through ebbs and flows. And certainly right now it feels like we're in the flow period where there's a lot of capital that is looking to be deployed, but people are very careful about, you know, how it gets deployed because of the complexity. When there is going to be the next downturn, I'm sure there will be, you know, capital that's going to be, you know, coming back, and they're going to look at this market a little bit more, challengingly, because it's not as big and unifying as, say, you know, Greater China or America. But that's where, you know, the smarter money will really look at how can I actually, you know, deploy capital, deploy it effectively, and effectively make money on my return.
You know, Sam, a few years ago, we saw this shift within China, where a lot of the overseas private equity firms had gone in looking for deals, you know, were doing some interesting deals. And then all of a sudden, a lot of the, you know, the Chinese nationals who had worked with those firms said, you know what, I don't need that international brand. In fact, I'm better off raising my own fund, deploying capital. I am Chinese in China. And that capital became directly competing directly with some of the foreign capital. Now, do you suspect, just as we were saying earlier, that China capital is flowing overseas, that Chinese capital will be competing with foreign, other Western capital in Southeast Asia?
Absolutely. I think your point regarding, you know, Chinese capital and Chinese, you know, companies itself looking for capital, they were, they came to a conclusion that they can work locally. Part of the reason is because obviously China is so large, so big, and has such a large educated base that the Chinese companies and Chinese people figured out, I can do this quickly. And by and large, they were very successful in doing so. As the opportunities in China get one more competitive and potentially the market slows down, now they're starting to say, you know, where else can I deploy capital? And interestingly, I think in the past, as I mentioned before, Chinese capital always traditionally looked in the big Western markets. So they went to big markets like the U.S. or Europe. They got, you know, marquee safe properties like a building in New York City or et cetera. As Chinese companies started becoming more active, a couple things happened. They actually recognized that when I make an active investment, whether it's inorganic or a organic investment, it becomes much harder. Part of the reason is because you're operating in a totally different environment now. And so you've seen a lot of Chinese companies sort of pull back a little bit because they say, this is not as easy as we thought. And when you add in the additional element of Chinese capital control, the U.S. government, you know, trying to block, you know, some more challenging transactions, and of course this trade war, it makes Chinese companies a little bit more nervous. And so you will see, I think, more Chinese companies looking in their backyard, specifically Southeast Asia, because they say, well, one, there's a large Chinese diaspora here that we actually can fundamentally get along with a little bit better. And I personally tend to think they think that the competition in Southeast Asia is probably not as competitive as it is in North America or Europe. And so, you've seen some investments in this region. I think you will continue to see more. But of course, I still do believe, you know, for most Chinese companies, the marquee investments are always going to be in the U.S. and Europe because, those companies, those investments tend to make more money on a general basis than Southeast Asia.
You had mentioned that one of the key areas of opportunity for private capital is manufacturing, finding perhaps tired operations, manufacturing facilities that need simply an upgrade or a little bit of a boost from technology deployment. You would imagine that the Chinese, being the manufacturing base for the world, with one of the highest rates of robotics deployments anywhere in the world, that it would be just the perfect partner or capital source for developing manufacturing capabilities in Southeast Asia.
That's an interesting one. I think, you know, with Chinese capital in particular, I think there's a lot of opinions about, you know, the pros and cons. And, you know, certainly for companies, Chinese companies that are looking to deploy and move operations to Southeast Asia, there is that ability. But of course, you know, there is a lot of concern right now around the world about whether it's going to be Chinese technology or, you know, Western technology. And so if it is a Chinese company going, you know, overseas, certainly they're going to be looking to deploy their own technology. I think there is an opportunity where you actually have companies that are sitting in the middle that say, I'm actually providing technology and I'm neither tying myself to China nor am I tying myself to, you know, the US. I'm really just a, you know, a Switzerland, if you will. I have the ability to really, you know, become a force in this part of the world.
This is Inside Asia. I'm speaking with Sam Choi, Managing Director of Evolution Advisors, a boutique investment and advisory firm based in Singapore. Sam was formerly with Microsoft and an astute observer of IT sector growth trends and acquisitions in the region. Before the break, we started to touch on the geopolitical aspects of a more powerful China. As listeners might expect, for many in the region, there are historical concerns around a growing Chinese presence. China was a dominating force in the world for thousands of years, had a brief period of retrenchment, and now seems to be making a comeback. This is a matter of some concern as Chinese companies target overseas markets where some ethnic majorities aren't comfortable with Chinese-backed businesses controlling parts of their respective economies. There's no doubting China's engineering, commercial, and financial acumen, and throughout the poorer countries of Asia, the Middle East, and Africa, that's the kind of investment and support that countries desperately need. I asked Sam if he's seeing resistance from the businesses in Asia that need funding but simply aren't comfortable opening the gates to Chinese money.
That's a great question. I think it also depends on the type of business that you're looking to operate in. I'm currently representing a Chinese partner that's in the digital marketing space. And for the various companies that we're talking to in North America and Europe, by and large, they largely accept, you know, that Chinese capital is available, and there are a lot of opportunities to access, you know, the strengths of this company in China. But when it comes to perhaps more advanced technologies, whether it's in the, you know, the next field of technologies, or whether it's robotics, artificial intelligence, you name it, people recognize the implications of controlling those sectors. And certainly, I think there is more concern about jumping into bed with a partner that may not necessarily play with an even playing field.
So in other words, it's one thing if a Chinese company wants to inject money into a smartphone manufacturing facility. It's another thing if they want to become a data center and move into the world of artificial intelligence, where kind of access to that data has broader implications.
Absolutely right. I think that's a great example where, you know, if I'm investing into a, you know, a smartphone manufacturer in India, I get access. That's great money. But if they're asking for data or they're asking for specific requirements, whether, you know, people talk about a potential backdoor, that becomes a big issue for a lot of companies.
Do you feel it's fair to call the Chinese out on this? Why are they any less responsible than the Americans or the Europeans when it comes to managing data?
Ooh, that's also a very difficult question. I think one of the things that I learned in my time in China, after really studying the Chinese economy and the Chinese market, I recognize that the power of the government has always been around. And so whether the Chinese people like it or not, they expect that the government is a player in their lives. And so I think the level of privacy for data or the acceptance of privacy and data in China is just a little bit different than it is in the rest of the world. I think, you know, certainly with Europeans, there's a lot of sensitivity in privacy and your data. And America certainly has that privacy issue as well. But I think just the going back into the history of China and the role of the government, people just expect it to be that way. And so all the services in China now, you know, whether you're using WeChat, whether you're using, you know, the various other services, people expect to have their data monitored, and so people know that, if I want to play on the fringes, I don't want to be on the major services.
So Sam, just does this mean that the by virtue of the Chinese people accepting the fact that government's going to be all up in their data privacy, reinforces the Chinese government's belief that it is their prerogative to have control over that data, and therefore that story travels and they can take that to other places in the world with the same type of mindset?
Well, I think that's currently a very large geopolitical discussion as well. And certainly I can't speak for the government, but I get the sense that they think that is perhaps their prerogative. But certainly, as Chinese companies and Chinese capital is being deployed overseas, these issues are actually now becoming front and center. And there are certainly concerns, and I've certainly been asked questions before whether or not the data from a potential acquisition is going to be used for different purposes. Mm-hmm. And certainly I'm working with a commercial enterprise in China, so we don't have any foreign government involvement. But when you start talking about larger Chinese enterprises, potentially state-backed Chinese enterprises, those questions and those answers get very blurry and people get very concerned. And I think it's going to be, on the Chinese companies, Chinese capital, as well as the acquirees to really ask the hard questions about what, how they're going to treat, people's data going forward. And it could be effectively another Chinese wall that we will buy, we'll buy your company, we'll deploy capital, but we're going to have strict operating procedures to operate, in your part of the world versus China.
And in order to give people the confidence to believe that your capital therefore works for me, because now you've addressed one of my leading concerns.
Yes, that's one of the major issues in terms of privacy. But one of the things we haven't talked about as much was simply just the overall operational and procedural controls that Chinese companies have.
Which you saw early on, you alluded to, like when you were first moving from Microsoft, Chinese companies are trying to understand what are those procedures look like. Now you're seeing it again.
Absolutely. For example, for many Western companies, they actually have a very good handle on how to handle human resource policies and human resource data. When I work with a Chinese company, they had actually said, we want access to all your human resource files. And I simply asked why, and they couldn't give me an answer, why they wanted it. And so
Because they asked.
But as a representing both, the Chinese partner as well as the U.S. partner, I said, no, because you don't have a policy for it. And I think that is one of the issues that Chinese companies have. But I certainly believe that over time, they will develop those policies and procedures of how to deal with, employees in foreign countries. But of course, when you get to more sensitive issues in terms of, how you're going to deal with it and what is going to be shared and what's not going to be shared, that's going to be a higher level question and something that people will certainly need to answer.
Sam, it strikes me, from my time out here, 35, 40, 45 years ago, when American or European companies were coming into Asia, they were bumbling their way in, making missteps around cultural issues or religious issues or human rights issues, things they just didn't understand. And then not because they were trying to be difficult or trying to be abrasive. In some cases, maybe they said, our way is the best way, but they had to learn. And in many cases, they did. But in many other cases, you still see bumbling going on. Do you think the Chinese, given their extraordinary ability to adapt, will be better at this than the Europeans, the Americans were when it comes to investing in this part of the world?
I'm not too sure if they will be better than the Western counterparts have. One thing I have learned just being in China and studying Chinese, I think they will probably learn faster, and they will figure out what is going to be acceptable quicker, because they will have the immediate responses of, if I deploy capital and it doesn't work, I'm going to try again. And one thing I have learned from the Chinese, they work very quickly, and they're not necessarily afraid to fail.
Sam, I suspect that your clients will be keeping you on your toes, therefore. So thank you so much for spending time with us and sharing your insights, and we wish you great luck.
Thank you for having me.
This is Inside Asia. You've been listening to my conversation with Sam Choi, Managing Director of Evolution Advisors, a boutique advisory firm specializing in cross-border investment and new business development. That brings us to the Asia Insider Minute, that part of the program where I do my best to distill some of the key takeaways from the conversation you've just heard and maybe add a few thoughts of my own. There's a lot to contemplate in my conversation with Sam, starting with the implications of a more aggressive and intentional Chinese expansionism. To think of walled-in China as an imperial force may seem like a novelty to some Westerners, but to people and nations in Asia-Pacific, it's a matter of historical record. For thousands of years, the Chinese were on the move, not necessarily as military invaders, but as the middle kingdom that welcomed tribute from its smaller neighbors. There was no shortage of kowtowing during China's dynastic period. Witnessing China on the move again evokes a bit of stored memory. China has and will always have the long view when it comes to contemplating and plotting the road of growth and expansion. The Maoist era and a 40-year period of experimental communism hit the pause button on that plan, but now we may be seeing the aspirational engines of Chinese ambition beginning to turn again. If land grab and patronage served the interest of Imperial China in centuries past, what's the new device for bringing the League of Nations to heel? Data, perhaps? Sam points out that within China, there's a general acceptance that the government has unencumbered access to all forms of digital data. They monitor social media from nearly a billion smartphone users. They have access to virtually everyone's healthcare record. And with nearly 35% of all retail sales in China occurring online, they know all they need to know about consumer spending habits. We've talked about the power and delicacy of data on previous programs. In my discussion with Ogilvy's Chris Graves, we looked at how, and with enough data, behaviors can be shaped and manipulated. In our episode with Anurag Banerjee, it became terrifyingly apparent how data can be leveraged for good and for evil. We've also spoken widely with the likes of Fortune's Clay Chandler, the Conference Board's David Hoffman, and with many others about the rise of China Inc. The degree to which China's data incursions are a threat to the world is subject to debate. The Americans would have us believe that the country's premier networking equipment company Huawei and smartphone manufacturer ZTE are bent on planting a bug in every house and every business. Digital espionage run amok. That's been enough for a handful of countries, including the US, New Zealand, and India, to block the sale of these Chinese products in their home markets. But how real is this? And where does xenophobia enter in? What do we know about other global network equipment makers like Cisco, Juniper, Siemens, Alcatel-Lucent, and others? There are scores of telecom equipment manufacturers with equal ability to embed listening capability in their systems. What fail-safe assurances do we have that they aren't bugging our homes and businesses as well, if at all? Whatever the case, how the world portrays a country or a company in the eyes of the consumer means something. So it is that as the US and other nations stoke fears on China, reservations naturally arise. That brings me back to my conversation with Sam. How does the growing anti-Chinese rhetoric impact China's overseas investment strategy? If as an overseas business you open the doors to Chinese capital, there are concerns, Sam tells us, that the Chinese will arrive with the assumption that they should have the same kind of access to your data and to the data of your employees as they would assume in China. And there's the rub. Why do you need access to data, Sam recounts asking a Chinese corporate client who didn't really have an answer. Maybe in acquiring a company or even a piece of a company, that feels simply like a right of ownership. Maybe it's something more insidious. Hard to know. This is the shape of the cultural clash that Chinese capital runs into when it moves overseas. In a sense, it's a version of the cultural clash that occurred 30 or 40 years ago when capital from the West sought to move into Eastern markets. There was a lot of bumbling around, a lot of insensitivity, and as a result, a lot of missed opportunity. Westerners had to learn about the Chinese in order to do business with them. Perhaps this is a similar dynamic, only flipped. For Sam, both cases involve developing core cultural competencies, and in both cases, mistakes will have to be made. The difference, Sam tells us, drawing on his long experience of doing business in China, is that the Chinese learn more quickly and are far less afraid to make mistakes. How China reshapes its image abroad may say more for its future success than any amount of money it could throw at overseas buying opportunities. For now, China may think money talks. But with apologies to Dr. Seuss, maybe investing, perhaps, means a little bit more. Until next time, this is Steve Stein saying, coming from the outside on Inside Asia.